I would just like to introduce Alicia Guerra, and she has worked for DCF and the Guardian Ad-Lib program. She was a supervising attorney in the 7th Circuit and is currently in the 20th Circuit. So, Alicia, if you want to take it away.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. I was asked to discuss paternity with everyone. It is a topic of interest in the state right now. We also had the Putative Father Registry be established in Florida in 2003, and not everyone in the state is familiar with it at this point. So there are a lot of interesting issues surrounding paternity and how it has evolved from the common law issue that we know it historically to be. And primarily, we need to discuss paternity because it's a material issue in every dependency and TPR case. Parents are entitled to notice. They're entitled to an opportunity to participate. They're entitled to a court-appointed counsel if they're found indigent. Non-custodial parents may even be entitled to custody if it's determined that the children will not be harmed if they're placed with them. It's an important issue to guardian ad litem, guardian ad litem staff and attorneys, because failure to properly and timely identify parents or prospective parents can delay permanency for the children we're representing. Some examples would be that if you fail to plead a legal father in a TPR, you've ended up with a child who still has a parent with intact parental rights and is not legally free to be adopted. Or if you pursue a TPR and you place allegations against an unmarried biological father and get a petition for TPR granted against him, you have got an order issued against a person who doesn't have any parental rights, and that is an error. Why those things are will become apparent as we discuss the materials further. I've started the materials with who a parent is, and I say parent because that's who is defined in the statute. Really, we are only talking about fathers today. Generally, it's only the identity of the father that we are trying to ascertain. They are normally is not an issue with ascertaining the identity of the mother. The definitional section of Chapter 39 explains to us that a parent is, of course, the one who gives birth to the child, and then any man who consents to the adoption of the child would be required under Section 63.0621 of the Florida statute. Now, a read of 63.0621 shows us that the persons who are required to consent to adoption, that the men or fathers, would be those who have adopted a child, those who have been established in a court proceeding to be a child's father, those who have acknowledged paternity under 382.0132C Florida statutes in regards to a child who was born to an unmarried woman, and any unmarried biological father who has complied with all the requirements of Chapter 63.062 sub 2, which includes timely filing a affidavit of acknowledgement of parenthood with the putative father registry and establishing a substantial relationship to the child. I do recommend a read of that subsection of the Florida statutes to really get a good feeling for what all an unmarried biological father has to do. There was a case which I referenced on page 3 in the last pages of your material called BBV PJM and KM. It's a first DCA case from 2006. In that case, the department had pled a putative father or unmarried biological father to be the child's father and treated him that way throughout the case. The mother did not object, the guardian ad litem did not object, and therefore the first DCA would not allow his parental rights to be terminated without his consent, because they determined that he had been established on everyone's actions in the dependency case to be the child's father. They specifically said that if the legislature had meant to say established in a court proceeding through an adjudication, that the legislature would have said it. Also, they amended the statute to require the acknowledgement of paternity, which would be executed under 382.0132C, to be filed prior to or no later than the date of a filing for a petition for TPR when that petition is filed under Chapter 63. When a petitioner files a petition for dependency or TPR and the identity of the father is unknown, the court is required to make an inquiry of the mother or legal custodian or any relative who happens to be at the generally the arraignment hearing. There is only five questions, and I left out the first and probably most important one, so I will amend those before they are placed on the website. But the only five questions are, was the mother married at the time of the birth or conception of the child? Was the mother cohabitating with any man at the probable time of birth or conception? I'm sorry, actually only conception. Is there a man who claims to be the father and who has made the mother payments or promises of support in connection with the pregnancy or in regards to the child? Is there any man named on the birth certificate, or has there been any man named in connection with the mother's application for public assistance? And is there any man who has acknowledged or claimed paternity in a jurisdiction where the mother or child resides? That is the inquiry under 39503 and 39803. So it's required in the dependency and required again in the TPR. You can also refer to Juvenile Rule of Procedure Form 8.969, which lays out the affidavit for the available parent or relative or person with knowledge to fill out to provide to the court. Now, those sections don't specifically mention the putative father registry, but the petitioner still must check the putative father registry to see if anyone has filed a claim of paternity. That is because because the definitional section, which refers us to Chapter 63, includes someone who's filed the affidavit of paternity and who has behaved in a manner that will establish him as a parent to be noticed of the proceedings. If the inquiry under 39503 or 39803 does not identify a prospective parent, the court can make that finding and proceed without further notice. Although we also know that you do have to, under 39503 and 39803, if the inquiry does produce the name or identity of a prospective father, a diligent search must be conducted for that person. To establish paternity under Chapter 39, the only option that's available in the chapter is for the prospective father who is found and located and noticed and who appears to execute an affidavit of parenthood. There is no proceeding under 39 to establish paternity in any other way. If the putative father appears in the dependency case, he swears out the affidavit of parenthood, he will be treated as a parent for the purposes of this chapter, unless the mother contests his claim of paternity. If the mother contests, then he must bring a 742 action to establish paternity. And I know I've mentioned a few statute numbers here. Chapter 742 is the section of Florida statute that deals with paternity actions for children who are born out of wedlock. And, of course, Chapter 63 is our adoption statutes, under which not just private adoptions, but also our own TPR adoptions. The petitioner, which is generally DCF, there is no obligation on the petitioner to establish paternity for anyone. In fact, chapter 63 makes it very clear that the obligation is on the unmarried biological father. 63.088 explains that an unmarried biological father, by virtue of having engaged in a sexual relationship with a woman, is deemed to be on notice that a pregnancy and adoption proceeding regarding that child may occur, and that he has a duty to protect his own rights and interests. So if you have an unmarried biological father who appears after being duly noticed in a dependency proceeding, his only remedies under our chapter follow 742 action. Not to say that it is any type of fundamental error for DNA to occur in the dependency case, but everyone should be aware that it is not provided for in Chapter 39. If the unmarried biological father fails to appear after he's been duly noticed of the proceedings, it is proper to get a finding that he was properly noticed, that he did fail to appear, and that he has failed to assert any claim of paternity. It is not appropriate to enter any judgments against him because he is not a person who has any parental rights. Now, we started this discussion by saying that the first thing mentioned in the chapter as a person being a parent is the mother who gives birth to the child and any man whose consent to the adoption is required. And the first person whose consent to the adoption is required is the mother's husband. This refers back to the presumption of legitimacy that was established at common law. The presumption of legitimacy was established to protect children. At common law, there were terrible repercussions for being born a child to an unmarried mother, or to having your legitimacy be disestablished. That child was not entitled to support from the father. And it was just not a situation that a child should be found in. And so the presumption was almost impossible to overcome at common law. Pravat, the first case that we're going to discuss, even notes that the public policy protecting children was created for the purpose of advancing the child's best interest, and that it had been found to be undefeatable, even over the claims of men proven beyond all doubt to be the biological father in at least 9 state Supreme Courts, several federal district courts, and the United States Supreme Court. At common law, the presumption could only be defeated by the husband, who was the reputed father. He had to bring an action to establish the child's legitimacy, and his burden was to prove that he was impotent or that he did not have access to his wife during the time of conception. And he had to meet this burden without testimony from himself or the wife. They were considered incompetent to testify. So this was a presumption that was almost impossible to overcome, and you never would have seen an unmarried biological father bringing an action to establish his paternity of a child born to a married woman, because that would have been a crime at common law. The first case I want to discuss is Pravat. You really cannot have a discussion of paternity without discussing the case of Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services versus Pravat. This is a 1993 Florida Supreme Court case. In that case, the state of Florida sought to get reimbursement based on a form petition filled out by the mother, which admitted she was married at the time of the child's birth, that the husband was placed on the birth certificate, that she had an extramarital relationship that produced the minor child, and that Mr. Pravat was the child's biological father. The state of Florida went after Mr. Pravat for child support, and he filed a writ of certiorari with the second DCA, which found that the trial court should have weighed his privacy interests and the child's best interests before ordering DNA testing. The Prevett court determined that an action seeking to transfer parental rights from a legal father to a putative father was akin to terminating the parental rights of the legal father. They found there must be a clear and compelling reason based primarily on the child's best interest to overcome the presumption of legitimacy even after the legal father is proven not to be the biological father. They further found that mere biology is not sufficient to constitute grounds for granting a paternity petition. Further cases developed from that point. If you don't read any other cases other than Prevett and maybe one other, GFC is the one you should read. It concisely discusses the history and development of the common law presumption of legitimacy and explains to us that where there's an intact marriage, that the paternity is established by law. Specifically in GCF, the court was dealing with a putative father who was trying to bring a paternity action under 742 to establish his rights to a child that was born to a mother and a husband who had lived continuously together from the time of birth and all of them acting as a family. The GFC court found that this particular father had no cause of action under common law, the Florida statutes, or the constitutions of Florida or the United States, because Chapter 742 only deals with cause of action for paternity where paternity has not been otherwise established by law, and where a child is born to an intact marriage, it has been established by law. They did carve out a suggestion. They made a suggestion that if this particular father or any other putative father in the future who may bring a proceeding might have a small chance of doing so under the Florida State Constitution's Due Process Clause. But to do so, they would have to establish that they had a substantial relationship with the child and that the transfer of parental rights from the legal father to the putative father is in the child's best interest. They again affirm Prevett's ruling that a scientific determination that a man is the legal the child's biological father is irrelevant to proceedings. It's all about what's in the child's best interest and whether or not there is grounds to terminate the parental rights of the legal father. There's other cases which go on to discuss the concept of an intact marriage and a putative father trying to bring his claim against a child born to an intact marriage. In IA, you have a couple who married after the conception of the child, but the mother and her husband believed the child to be theirs. The third man, who the mother had a relationship with prior to her marriage, also acted in a way believing, to suggest a belief that the child was the husband's and not his. The three of them lived as a family until the putative father brought an action to establish paternity. The court in IA stated it specifically agreed with the holding in GFC and added to GFC's holding, stating that where the mother and the reputed father marry after the birth of the child, paternity is established by law. Section 742.091 of the Florida statutes codifies that idea. It does provide that where the mother and the man they believe to be the father marry, the child is a child born to the marriage. TB can be contrasted with IA. In TB, you had a child who was born, and you had two men in the delivery room. It's not clear that anyone knew which one of the two men was the child's actual father. The mother went on to have one of those men named on the birth certificate, and he and the mother and the child lived together with the second man, with the man on the birth certificate supporting the child. At some point later, the other man, who we'll call the putative father, filed an action for paternity. The mother responded by marrying the man she had been living with and raising the child with and holding the child out as a child born to an intact marriage. The court refused to extend the holding in IA to allow the presumption of legitimacy to be used as an affirmative defense. They did not feel that the man the mother had married was actually the reputed father of the child, and that seemed to be a big part of their decision. However, we know from reading Johnson v. Ruby that 12 days makes a big difference when you're dealing with paternity actions. In Johnson v. Ruby, Mr. Johnson was the putative father, and he filed a 742 paternity action 12 days after the mother's marriage to the to her husband. There is no discussion in the case as to whether or not he was the reputed father. This was determined to be an intact marriage, and there was no discussion about the paternity action was dismissed, and the marriage was not allowed to be attacked. SB attempted, well, SB actually set up a very strong rule. It found that the time-honored presumption of legitimacy can defeat a paternity claim of a man clearly determined to be the child's father. It found that a putative biological father could not maintain the paternity action where the woman and her husband objected, and that if the legal father objected to a paternity action by the putative biological father, that he would be a stop from later denying paternity and supporting the child. The facts of that case are interesting because the mother and her husband separated and reconciled on several different occasions, including divorcing and remarrying, and the child was clearly conceived and born during the time that she, the mother, and her husband were separated. And the putative father's name was placed on the birth certificate. What we can glean from those cases is that where a putative father, whether or not he can prove beyond any doubt that he is the biological father, where he only pleads that there is a biological link to the child, he will not prevail over the presumption of legitimacy. There is no protection for a biological link to a child under common law, the Florida statute, the Florida Constitution, or the United States Constitution. A presumption will not be created in every case, though, where a mother marries after the birth of a child. In the case of CMN, which is on page 9 of your materials, the mother married her husband 8 months after the child was born. They never held him out to be the reputed father, and therefore it was determined that no presumption of paternity existed in that case. Now, there are some narrow exceptions for defeating the presumption of paternity. Fernandez v. Fernandez is one such example. In that case, the putative father was able to plead and show that there was a compelling reason to support the transfer of parental rights from the legal father to him, and that the transfer was in the child's best interest. In that case, the mother and her husband had lived together sporadically and for brief periods of time. The mother and her husband divorced. the husband did not exercise his visitation rights consistently or pay child support consistently. Mr. Fernandez showed that he was the only man who really had a relationship with the children. He had married the mother after her divorce from her first husband, and they had actually had a third child together, and the five of them lived as an intact family. So that was an exception that was able to defeat the presumption of legitimacy. The next case that you should be aware of is Lander v. Smith, and you can contrast that with the SB case. The facts are not that unsimilar, where you have a couple who had a long period of separation and the wife conceived a child that was clearly the child of the other man. She did not even live in the same state as her husband. The putative father's name was placed on the birth certificate. This is in violation of the Vital Statistics Statutes 382.013, which requires that the husband be named on the birth certificate. So where a man other than the husband is named on the birth certificate, that is error, and the husband is still the legal father. The court said that the test for overcoming presumption in this case is that it will not be overcome unless common sense and reason are outraged by applying it to the facts at hand, and that the burden of proof must, the petitioner must show a clear and compelling reason which is based primarily on the child's best interest. The record in this case was absent of any relationship between the child and the legal father. And that was primarily how the putative father was able to get the case remanded back to the trial court so that he would have an opportunity to present evidence of his substantial relationship with the child and the child's best interest. Because the petition in the trial court was dismissed without that evidence being presented. And the fourth DCA was very concerned that we had a child who had no relationship with the legal father and was not guaranteed the nurturance and support that the presumption of legitimacy is designed to protect. So in this situation, they specifically stated they were carving out a narrow exception based on these facts to make certain that this child, TRS, was protected. They did not issue any orders directing a paternity order be entered, but for a hearing to determine if overcoming the presumption was in the child's best interest. Pravat had mentioned some factual circumstances where the presumption may be overcome, and Hill v. Hill is your next case. I believe one of those exceptions the court was referring to was in looking back at the Hill v. Hill case. It's on page 11 of your materials. This is the only case I came across where a mother defeated the presumption of legitimacy. She alleged that she had not lived with her husband in 7 years and that the putative father was the only man she had had a sexual relationship with during that time. It was clear from the record that her husband had essentially abandoned her and was providing no support for the child. The case is concerning because the putative father had executed an affidavit to the state showing that he would provide food and milk for the child, which leads to the only conclusion that the mother was receiving public assistance to survive, and she was attempting to establish child support from the putative father. So in that situation, the mother was able to overcome the presumption of legitimacy, and it was clearly in the child's best interest because the child had no legal father supporting her and needed the support of the putative father. In 2006, the Florida legislature added on to the Prevett holding. They noted that Prevett had found that legal fathers, who are the mother's husband, the men who would otherwise be placed on the birth certificate if there is no husband, etc. That's the way it's defined by Black's Law Dictionary. However, in this case, they are really only talking about legal fathers in the sense of the men who are married to the mother at the time of birth or conception. They explained that Privat had said that legal fathers are entitled to notice of paternity actions because they have an unmistakable interest in those proceedings, but they admitted that they had failed to establish any procedures for protecting their interest. So the Cummings case is important because it declares the legal father to be an indispensable party to any action for paternity. Now, so far we've been discussing unmarried biological fathers in the sense of them conceiving children with married women. We're now going to move on to unmarried biological fathers who conceive children born to unmarried women. The next, Lair v. Robinson is a U.S. Supreme Court case that also agrees that the court will not protect a mere biological link. There has to be something more, and it is notable that New York had a putative father registry back in 1982. So that is a place for us to look for cases concerning the putative father registry since our registry is so new. The next three cases, in re adoption of baby A, In re baby RPS and in re baby H are very similar on their facts. In re adoption of baby A, you have a mother who was cohabitating with a man, and actually they were living with his parents at the time. They were all living together as a family. They conceived a child together, and he wasn't very excited about it, so she was concerned about his willingness to be a father. She miscarried that child and at some point later moved out of A.S., who is the putative father of baby A, out of his parents' home. They had conceived baby A prior to her moving out. She did not tell him that she was pregnant. She gave birth to this child and called the adoption agency the day of the birth. The adoption agency filed a voluntary petition to terminate her parental rights and alleged that the father was unknown. Although in their petition, they gave his physical description and stated that he lived with his parents. So it was clear from the face of the petition that he was known, he was just not disclosed. The trial court forced the mother to identify the father. She was conducting the inquiry under Chapter 63, which mirrors our inquiry under Chapter 39-503 and Chapter 39-803. So when she asked if mom was cohabitating with any man at the probable time of conception, mom had to disclose A.S.'s name. Now, under Unified Family Court, when the father filed an objection and a motion to establish paternity after he received the notice that was sent to him after the judge's inquiry, his petitions were sent to the same judge. Now, that judge determined that A.S. had failed to timely register with the putative father registry. He did so after the notice was sent to him of the pending adoption proceeding, and terminated his parental rights, and then it dismissed the paternity action as moot. Those are almost the same facts as in re baby RPS. The only difference in the second case is that the adoption agency specifically pled the unmarried biological father as part of their petition and requested an order terminating his parental rights. In those cases, the court erred because these unmarried biological fathers, not being people who have to consent to an adoption under Chapter 63.0621, they are not parents and they have no parental rights to terminate. So the same analysis, because the grounds are substantially the same under Chapter 63 as they are under Chapter 39.806, none of those grounds apply to these men, and they have no parental rights to terminate. The court in AS found that because Chapter 742 did not specifically bar a paternity proceeding for a father who failed to timely register, that petition should have been resolved prior to any decision on the adoption petition. And so it was remanded to the trial court for that determination to be made prior to taking any action on the adoption. The same occurred in RPS and in In Re Baby H. Now, the court in In Re Baby H has certified a question to the Florida Supreme Court, which we, as far as I'm aware, are waiting an answer for. If Tom Young is on the line, he may be able to tell us if it's even been briefed at this point. But they certified the following question. They are asking for determination on the question, in a proceeding on a petition for termination of parental rights pending adoption, may a putative father's rights in relation to the child be terminated based on the putative father's failure to properly file a claim of paternity with the Florida Putative Father Registry? AFL is the last case that I have for discussion. It's an interesting case. In that case, the Department of Children and Families voluntarily terminated the parental rights of the mother and the legal father. They did this in November of 2004. There was a putative biological father who did find out that he was a putative biological father about the time of the filing of the petition, which was several months earlier in August of 2004. This putative father, AFL, did not appear in the dependency or TPR proceedings to claim paternity until December 2004, approximately a month after the child's parental rights were terminated, or the rights of the mother and legal father were terminated to the child. When he appeared, the court did order DNA testing, and he was determined to be the biological father. At that point, he made an untimely registration with the Putative Father Registry and filed a motion to establish his paternity. The trial court denied his motion, filing that his untimely registration does not preserve his claim of paternity. I think that's an important case for us to be aware of in dealing with our own TPRs, but it's also notable that in this particular situation, you had a putative biological father petitioning to establish paternity of a child who was born to a married couple, and the mother and legal father's parental rights were terminated, yet the court focused on the putative father's untimely registration with the Putative Father Registry as the basis for dismissing his petition.
Thank you, Alicia, for doing this for us. We appreciate it, and there's a lot of good information